This is Dr. David Stevens, your host on Christian Doctor's Digest. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to join me. We're going to be talking in this issue about difficult situations, and I guess that goes with the territory of being in healthcare. We're often next to people when they face difficult issues in their lives, and we help them go through them. But also, we have to remember, we face difficult situations as well. And God is there to assist us. And we've got some great speakers who are going to come in and give us some advice in both of those areas. I think you're going to find that helpful. And let's start off with an issue that I hope you'll never face, but you may. First, let me introduce you to Matt Anderson, a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist, a CMDA member, and he currently practices at a family clinic in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. He and his wife of 39 years have 4 children and 14 grandchildren, and I'm going to let Matt explain to you what we're going to talk about. Matt, you have a story that all of us wish we don't have or won't have, but I think we need to hear it as we approach this issue of right of conscience. This is coming close to all of us. It came close to you. Tell us what happened.
Well, I worked for a large healthcare company in Minnesota, and I thought things were going just fine, and then I gave a grand rounds presentation, and all your listeners know what that is, of course, and being a John Patrick enthusiast, I've listened to all of his tapes, and I've even gotten to speak to him at the big missions conference in Louisville. I had always been interested in the Oath of Hippocrates, and it was my turn to do the grand rounds in our department, so I asked to do it on dusting off the Oath of Hippocrates in the 21st century. And I liberally cited Dr. Patrick in my talk and had a bunch of my own things there. And a couple of weeks after the talk, they called me in and said, resign or be fired because of your talk. And then they said, oh, and there's a few other things, too. And they listed some things that made me sound like I was just a terrible doctor.
You're an OBGYN physician.
I'm an OBGYN, right.
And you were working in a department with other OBGYNs.
Right. There were 5 of us in the department, and I'd had some conflict with the head doctor of quality for the organization over some of the measures that we had to meet in order to be considered, you know, good doctors. And one of the measures was on chlamydia screening. Since I was pro-life, I attract a lot of married and Christian and devout Catholic women who had large families and had been virgins when they were married and one partner for life. And I was to do a chlamydia test every year on these patients. 78% of my patients had to meet that measure, and I just didn't have hardly any chlamydia in my practice. And I argued against it by saying that I was asking my patients, you know, informed consent, do you... my organization wants me to do a chlamydia test on you. Is that okay with you? And my unmarried patients would all say yes, and my married patients mostly would say something to the effect, well, you can if you want, but you don't need to. And I had 3 patients almost walk out. So I had run into conflict with him over that, and then he attended my talk and was quite offended with my talk on the Oath of Hippocrates, primarily about a comment that I made about the religious beliefs which are more fatalistic, meaning some religious beliefs just kind of throw up their hands when something happens and say, will of God. Well, followers of Islam, that certainly is more of an issue there than it is with Christianity. And that example I gave, and then also talking about Christianity and the lack of knowledge that most doctors had about that, was quite offensive to my audience.
So what happened next?
Well, they wouldn't let me leave the room to call my wife, so I had to call my wife in front of this doctor and the HR woman, and it took me about 5 minutes to convince her that I was being dismissed. And they said that I would either be fired for cause because I was a bad doctor and had given that talk, or I could resign, and in which case my name wouldn't go to the National Practitioner Data Bank and I wouldn't be investigated by the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice. And after talking with her a bit, one of the more humiliating moments of my life, I decided that I would resign. So I resigned, and they had security outside the door, and I had to clean out my office that night, and they walked me off the property and said, don't come back.
Wow. Like you had a communicable disease that they had to protect everyone from.
You know, I, eventually, and you'll find this out as we discuss this, I did take them to binding arbitration, and I found out in the trial that security did have an order that if I showed up, they were to throw me in a hammer lock and throw me off the property.
Wow.
I don't know if they thought I was going to bomb the place or what. I'd worked there 7 years. I had the highest patient satisfaction of any doctor in the entire hospital system and was one of the busiest docs there. I was on the board of directors of the hospital, and I was on the medical executive committee.
Wow.
I thought I was doing great.
This must have been devastating to you.
Oh, my. When I woke up the next morning, it's the first time I've been unemployed since I was 16 years old. How do you respond when your chosen profession, the one that you felt called by God to practice and one that you love dearly, was suddenly just pulled out from underneath you? And I immediately started on a job search. You know, I wasn't thinking of doing anything with my former employer. Obviously, they didn't want me for whatever reason, and so I started looking for work right away and applying for licenses in other states and looking for locum tenens work and calling every place that I could find that had an opening. And, you know, a lot of tears with my wife and a lot of prayer. And it's one of those moments in time where you really decide, you know, what is my faith really like here? Is my faith just for the good times? And it's not. And I'm glad that through the years I've been a student of history and read about other Christians. You know, William Tyndale translated the Bible out of the original Greek and Hebrew, and the King of England put a price on his head. He had to run to France, and then his best friend betrayed him. He was 2 years in a cold prison and then burned at the stake. And the King of France had mercy on him and allowed him to be clubbed to death before they burned him. Adoniram Judson, missionary to Burma, lost three wives and almost all of his children in Burma, and finally got so sick himself he had to try and make it back to the United States. In the middle of the Indian Ocean, he died with no friends, no family, and his body was just thrown overboard. You know, my problem looked pretty minor to that. And, you know, God in his sovereignty and his mercy is really the in-charge guy. And I had a lot of people come up to me and say, don't worry, God will have something better for you later. And like God's a genie in the bottle, and that's not it. And the verses that I really depended on at that time were Habakkuk 3, 17 and 18. And that was my hope and stay through this entire event. It says, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. And that was my hope and stay. And I realized that, you know, just because bad times have come doesn't mean I stop rejoicing, doesn't mean that God is not real, doesn't mean that he doesn't care. His best for me may not have been what I thought my best for me was, but I knew that the day that I see him face to face, it'll all become clear.
Yeah. So what happened with the job hunt, Matt? I mean, obviously, you've been fired from a position that kind of follows you.
Well, I resigned, technically,
yeah.
You know, resign or be fired, so I resigned. But when people asked, I told them the truth. I mean, what can you do?
Right.
You know, why did you resign? Well, they said I'd be fired if I didn't resign.
Yeah.
Well, that's not exactly a big selling point. I was only able to get one interview, and the interview that I had, the guy walking me to the car said, you know, you're a great candidate. We really like you. We'll have a contract for you next week, and no contract came. And I called back, and they said they were interviewing other people. And the other places that I tried, I didn't even get an interview after a couple of conversations on the phone. So it was very discouraging. And so after about 2.5 months, I was really getting kind of discouraged. one of my former patients who goes to my church said, you know, there's this pro-life clinic in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, which is a suburb of St. Paul, just to the north. And I looked it up on the internet, and it's a small family practice clinic and staffed by devout Catholic people who are all pro-life. And just out of the blue, I wrote them a letter and said, you ever thought of hiring an OB-GYN? And they had been praying for an OB-GYN doctor, a Catholic OB-GYN doctor, of course. But when they found out that I shared their worldview and that not prescribing birth control would not be a problem for me, they embraced me with open arms, and that's where I started. Now, unfortunately, they didn't have any money to pay me, so I pretty much have started my practice from scratch and had to live on savings for at least a year, savings and retirement, before I started making any money. And even that's much less than what I was making before.
Sure, sure. So what happened with your employer? I mean, how did you make the decision that you needed to do something to defend your conscience or defend conscience?
Well, my contract said I couldn't practice within 15 miles of where I formerly worked, and this clinic was 17 miles away. And I was able to get hospital privileges, I think, because the hospital system I applied to had a Catholic hospital in it, and there were a couple of pro-life OB-GYNs on the committee, I found out later. So mm-hmm. I think that's how I got privileges, which was God's grace. And my contract said that my former employer had to notify all my former patients of my name, address, phone number, where I was practicing, and when I wrote him a letter in January to tell him I'd found this place, I got no response, so I sent him a letter a month later, and 5 weeks later I got a response. I sent the second letter certified. 5 weeks later I got a response that said, oh, we already did that, and they had a copy of a letter that said basically, well, Dr. Anderson isn't here anymore. He's please schedule with our wonderful doctors. And that was it. And they wouldn't do anything else. They just refused. And at that point I told my wife, you know, somebody needs to hold this company accountable. First, they violated my contract getting rid of me, because my contract had language in it that said, in matters of law and ethics, I was to use my best medical judgment. And clearly, you know, chlamydia screening on someone who doesn't need it is a matter of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And my talk was clearly a matter of ethics. So I didn't think they had followed my contract dismissing me. And the second thing is that they wouldn't clearly follow the language of the contract and let my former patients know where I was. So that's when I decided to take them to court. Actually, it specified a binding arbitration, so I took them to binding arbitration, and it was 2 years from the time I was dismissed before we finally had the trial.
And what happened?
Well, it was interesting. I found out in the course of discovery and depositions that my former partner, who worked right beside me for 7 years, who was a very liberal feminist woman, pro-abortion, 6 months before I was told I had to resign or be fired, had started a whispering campaign against me and had compiled a list of my medical sins over the last 7 years. You know, every follow-up bleep or blunder that I was ever involved in, she had on a list of how terrible a doctor I was. And they were talking about this in some of the committees that they had, unbeknownst to me. Didn't know anything about this list at all. And then the doctor who was the head of quality also talked to a few people who had some rumors about my practice, and he wrote those down. So they had three pages single-spaced about what a terrible doctor I was. And then when I gave my talk, that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, and they decided I was not salvageable, is the word they used, and that's when they decided to dismiss me. And I didn't even know about this list beforehand.
Right.
If I hadn't sued, I would have never known about it.
They were working behind your back. So what happened during the arbitration?
Well, it was interesting. Some of the problems that they said that I had were just bizarre. They said I did too many hysterectomies. Well, the corporation that I worked for only required the OB-GYNs to work a 3-day week in the office, and then they had 1 day just for surgery where they didn't have to be in the office, and then they had 1 day off. Well, most of the docs didn't do a lot of surgery, so they really had a 3-day work week, and then maybe they'd work part of a morning for surgery, and the rest of the time they'd have off. Well, I worked a 5-day week. I started 8 on Monday morning and worked until 5 on Friday night. I was a 1.5 full-time equivalent doctor, and plus, they all had rules about when to see a consult. You know, they'd say, well, I'll see a consult, you know, only on Tuesdays between 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock, something like that. And I would work people in the same day. I would just talk to my family doctors who were referring patients to me and say, well, when would you like her seen? And if it was today, I'd work her in that day. I'd just let them decide, and I'd stay late and see them if I had to. Well, that made me kind of a preferred person to send patients to me with gynecologic issues, which usually ended up being surgery. So I was more busy surgically, but they said I was doing too many hysterectomies. Well, in the trial, it came out that for the number of hours worked in the clinic, my partner, who worked to get rid of me, actually was doing more hysterectomies than I was per number of hours worked in the clinic. They said I used too many narcotics, and that was mostly because I just had more post-ops. But it was just a rumor from the medical assistants in the clinic. They had never looked at a single chart. They even asked my former partner, because she was kind of the lead in the clinic, well, this sounds serious, doctor, that someone would use too many narcotics. And her comment was, well, it was a concern, but I knew he was taking good care of his patients, so I didn't bother to review any chart. That was one of the reasons I was dismissed. And then one of the more distressing things, they used the word pro-life a couple of times, once in regard to me not putting in IUDs, saying that I wasn't really providing a full range of gynecologic services because I refused to put in IUDs under the mistaken notion that they were abortifacients. Well, I don't think that's a mistaken notion at all. If you read the package insert, it says that it doesn't cause abortion, but they consider the pregnancy is not starting until implantation,
right,
which means that five-day-old embryo just passes through. Well, that's an abortion to me. And the other place they used it was in genetic testing. They contended that I didn't counsel my patients on genetic testing because I was pro-life and thought they might get an abortion, and that wasn't true at all. I did counsel them, except I did tell them the truth. You know, I didn't dance around it. I'd say the purpose is to find a baby with a handicap so you can abort it if you want. And that's what happens to 95-98% of babies that are found with a handicap. So it was a true statement. And when patients realize the truth of that, even the secular patients, a lot of them don't have it done.
Right, right.
And then they also, there was language in some of the, although it was interesting, the opposing attorney asked every single one of their witnesses, now did you want to dismiss Dr. Anderson because he was pro-life? Oh, no. Or because of his religious convictions? Oh, no. But yet, those two things were in writing. And then also, the one doctor testified that my, how did he put it? In writing, it had on one document, no one could claim this, is that I had extreme right-wing radical viewpoints. They also, one place in the testimony said that I was an extreme religious zealot. And, you know, their complaints against my talk were basically, the one complaint testimony against my talk was that I said a physician couldn't really be ethical unless they believed in God. Well, you know, it was about the oath, for goodness sake. It wasn't. That's just what the oath says. And then also about the comments I made about Christianity and the lack of knowledge that doctors have about that. And really, I was trying to educate about faiths that are more fatalistic as well, but that whole point was just missed by everybody. They just heard that somehow I was against Muslim physicians and therefore I was, or Muslims, and therefore I was a bigot.
They find what they want to find to justify what they already believe. So what happened? What was the final verdict?
Well, the trial took a week, and it was, you know, to hear... this was probably the hardest thing, is to have all those doctors, all those people that you knew, get up and say just horrible things about you.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to listen, and it's a very depressing sort of a situation. But I made my points, and it was interesting, too, that they just didn't seem to have any proof on any of these charges. So when the decision came down 3 months later, the judge said that the charges against me were based on rumor and innuendo and a few facts, he said, but they were basically unproven in testimony. And he said in his decision that the reason I was dismissed was because of my talk. And they had called me into a meeting, oh, about a week after my talk, in an email with no agenda, and I was on call and I missed that meeting, and they decided I did that because I was somehow they thought I knew what the meeting was about and just blew it off, and I didn't. And so the judge said because I missed that meeting, it made this one doctor angry, and then I gave my talk, and that's why I was dismissed. So the judge sided with me completely on the violations of my contract. They had violated my contract in many ways, that they had no cause to dismiss me. He said because of that, I was forced to resign because they didn't give me a true choice. You know, they said resign or be fired for cause, but they had no cause to dismiss me. His comment was, my talk was my own opinion and didn't qualify for a dismissal, and that pretty much anybody could see that. So that's what the decision was. But then I was asking, in an employment dispute, the only thing you can ask for are lost, past, and future wages. One of the things that was interesting in the testimony is that they had one of the places that I'd called to try and work testify over the phone, and what they said was, Dr. Anderson, we Googled his name and found the writing that he's done for World Magazine and also the article he put in his church newsletter, and we realized from that he just would not be a good fit for our organization, so we did not grant him an interview. And so the judge in his decision said, because of the writing I had done publicly, and his exact words were that the writing that spoke against, he said, teamwork and protocol medicine. And I did speak some against protocol medicine because I don't think it's good. It makes people quit thinking, and it's I think how euthanasia and death panels and abortion are all going to be introduced as medical care and not euthanasia. So I did speak against that. And he said because of that, I wasn't hireable. I was a poor hire. And it's no wonder I couldn't find a job. He said my employer wasn't their fault, so they shouldn't have to pay me very much money. And then the other thing he said was I didn't try hard enough to find work, as if 3 months trying to find work and getting all those turndowns was not hard enough. And then he said since I joined a small clinic that didn't have much money, that was my fault too. And so he reduced my award substantially, so it wasn't nearly enough to cover the savings I lost or the retirement, but it will cover about three-fourths of my startup expense, so I'm glad for that.
Yeah.
And it was a decision in my favor, so I was glad for that.
What would you say to the docs and others that are listening? First of all, spiritually, and you touched on that God didn't waste this pain. Elaborate a little bit more. What's been the impact on your family, colleagues, as well as yourself?
Well, I had wonderful support from my family. I have four wonderful children who are all Christians, and they were a huge source of support. My wife and I have 14 grandchildren, and they all knew that Papa had lost his job, but you know, God is good, and he's going to see him through. Mm-hmm. And my wife was a constant source of support, and my church family was unbelievably supportive through this. I mean, they read my talk, and they supported me on the things that I had written. I got good comments from my World Magazine articles and that. So it was good to have people say, you know, these are okay. These aren't terrible. They aren't bad. But it is a traumatic event. Every time you get a mailing from your attorney or a phone call or an email that says they're saying this or whatever, you know, you get this knot in your stomach, like, right, should I really be doing this? And there were many people that told me, don't sue, you know, that's not a Christian thing. And I guess the reason that I did it was to hold the company accountable, and not so much for me, but for doctors who come after me.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to try and get their attention and say to them, look, you dismiss a Christian physician for giving a talk on the Oath of Hippocrates, which is a talk on medical ethics from a Christian point of view. You paid for that. And so when that happens again, don't fire that doctor.
Right.
That was my hope, you know. And I hope I accomplished that with the judge's decision. I don't know, but I certainly hope I have.
Yeah. Or they'll try to sanitize their records better next time around.
Well, yeah, I suspect.
Yeah, I mean, but I agree with you. We've got to stand on this. I mean, I'm not one looking for conflict, but if not, we're just going to be pushed out of healthcare, and that almost happened to you.
It did.
They would have been happy if you'd never practiced again.
Oh, very much. Yeah. Very much. And actually, in the testimony of the trial, they'd always ask, well, how is it now that Dr. Anderson is gone? Because, you know, in meetings, I would argue against some of these things that medicine was doing, these, quote, advancements where everybody quits thinking and and everybody's the same and nobody's any different and every patient is the same and no one is unique anymore and everybody gets the same treatment regardless. And I would argue in meetings, and they'd, and so the opposing attorney would ask, so how's it been since Dr. Anderson's left? Oh, it's much calmer now. I'm glad.
Yeah, groupthink has taken over.
Everybody's a yes man.
Yeah.
But practically speaking, I think a couple of things that I would note. First is that a violation of the diversity, tolerance, multicultural concepts in a large organization, a large healthcare organization, ranks right up there with committing a felony mm-hmm. or showing up to work drunk. You're dismissed.
You'd probably do better showing up drunk.
You might. Yeah,
they would send you to rehab and try to bring
and
try to get you back in the saddle.
Another thing is that the concept of tolerance and diversity, and most of your listeners, I'm sure, know this, does not extend to pro-life Christianity or pro-life Catholic doctors. And in fact, we're viewed as the de facto intolerant people. We are bigots until proven otherwise. And I even had one person tell me that you can't discriminate against the majority, meaning since I was a white male, anything they did was fine because by definition, I can't be discriminated against.
Right.
And the other thing that was kind of interesting, I thought, was that even though I won, the judge was so matter-of-fact in his statement that said, well, you're not very hireable because of what you wrote, which means that if you're public with your faith, if you're public with your pro-life stance, and it's accessible to someone you're going to look for work from, you might not get an interview. You might not get hired. They might just say, not interested. That's really a tragedy in my mind, because if you look at the flip side, you know, if a minority or Muslim, Hindu, whatever person you want to think of who's not Christian, had written something in their religious magazines, do you think they would not be considered for employment?
Yeah.
I don't think that would matter then.
Right.
That's just a guess, but I just don't think it is. And the other thing is that everybody denied that it had anything to do, all of the people testifying against me, that it had anything to do with my pro-life views or my faith, but yet there it is in the documents right there written down.
Yeah, they did. They knew they didn't want to appear that way, and that would be grounds for them to be censured, so they denied it. And when there is no truth, there is no problem with doing that.
You know, nobody's ever going to say you're pro-life or you're a Christian, I'm going to fire you. That's not what they say. They gin up a bunch of charges just like they did here. They don't even check into them, and next thing you know, you're out the door and security's got you by the arm. And that's a very difficult thing, and I think doctors just need to be aware of that and just know that that's how strong this movement is, that it's not a joke, and you need to be sensitive to that. Now, what does that mean for keeping your job? Do you quiet down? Do you not stand for Christ? Do you not stand for being pro-life? Well, I don't think we can do that. I think you have to still do what God calls you to do and know that He's taking care of you, and it's Him we're serving, and it's Him that we're going to stand all alone in front of the judgment seat. No one else will be with us at all, and we'll have to answer for our actions. So
yeah.
I feel good about the talk I gave. I feel good about the writings that I've done, and I am in a better clinic now, and it's wonderful. The other thing I might mention is that our Catholic friends really have it tough. You know, if you have a devout Catholic physician who doesn't prescribe birth control and is pro-life, the Catholic Medical Society just had their national meeting here, and they even had speakers talk about it. My one partner was chased out of her clinic when she quit prescribing birth control, and your practice dwindles because people won't come. So there is a price to pay if you want to take a stand on something like that. And it's very difficult for those doctors to function. I've had about 3 calls since I've started here from Catholic residents who are finishing their residency and they want to practice in a clinic that doesn't prescribe birth control. And I've had to tell them, I'm not that busy. I can't take a partner on. I'd love to, but I can't.
Yeah.
Yet. So.
Well, Matt, I want to thank you for challenging us, informing us, And more importantly, for being such a great witness, I think, to all of us. I know when we first communicated, I thought, wow, what a story of being faithful to God first, and even through terribly difficult times, seeing that you, even then He's in control, He cares, and that He, you know, the world may be booing, but He's there applauding. That you've stood faithful, and I just want to thank you for being such a great witness to us, and to be assured of my prayers as you move forward. You're one of my new heroes.
Oh, Dave, those are very kind words, and you just don't know how much I appreciate them. And I so appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this and share my story. And I have to say, too, that I love CMDA, one of my favorite organizations in the whole world, and you guys are my heroes.
Wow. I hope what happened to Matt doesn't happen to you, but with what's happening in our culture, I think all of us are vulnerable at this time. And as we continue to fight for your right of conscience in Washington, the other side of the coin is we're seeing our culture moving further and further away from moral principles and religious freedom. And so I think we need to pray, first of all, and second, be willing to jump in and help using our influence as we make you aware of opportunities. As bills come before Congress, things like this where a letter, a note, a phone call can help push forward the protection that we all want and that we all need. Also, you may have heard in that interview about John Patrick's lecture and how that got Matt in some difficulties at his practice site. You may want some of those lectures. They're dynamite, I guess, in lots of different ways. And we have a great set of Augustine College Conference lectures of John Patrick that you may want to get, looking at faith issues and apologetics. And as you know, John teaches us each person in very specific ways that apply to us as we apply his lectures into our own life. So I encourage you to get that. They're available at 888-230-2637 or go on our website at cmda.org where you can order these things online. Jim, it's great to be with you for another TaxWise moment. What's happening in the law that people should know about, especially as we begin to approach the end of the year?
Last year, people may recall that the Bush-era tax cuts were extended, or at least parts of the Bush-era tax cuts were extended through the end of 2013. And one of those provisions is expected to expire in December and not be renewed, and that's the IRA charitable rollover.
Okay, explain that to us. All of us have some IRAs. What is a charitable rollover?
It's a great provision in the tax code that enables a taxpayer age 70 and a half or older who has an overfunded IRA to give to charity directly from the IRA free of any tax. So for most people, that will save them about $20 for every $100 that they would contribute to charity.
And that makes it just a lot simpler than taking money out of your IRA, paying taxes on it, giving it as a charitable gift, getting some sort of deduction, but maybe not to that level. Great news.
Yeah, it sure is. And again, I think that, you know, for a lot of our people, this could be the last year that this tax benefit is in effect. It does have a couple of provisions that you need to be aware of. The age limit, people need to be 70 and a half or older. It only applies to traditional IRAs. If a member has a Roth IRA, they cannot contribute directly from that. And it has a cap of $100,000 per taxpayer, so $200,000 for married couples.
Well, that's something you need to think about, because a lot of us have a lot of money in our IRAs. Instead of taking it out of current income or whatever, this is a great opportunity to help your church, help CMDA, help any other charity that you're interested in supporting as you approach the end of the year. If people need help in this or any other questions about stewardship, how can they contact you?
Best way is through email at stewardship@cmda.org or our toll-free number, 888-230-2637.
Jim, thanks again for another TaxWise bit of advice.
Thank you.
One of the things I appreciate is members who work in the academic arena. It's not easy, and especially in obstetrics and gynecology, where there's so much antagonism in our medical centers and medical schools and residency programs towards pro-life views. That's why it's a pleasure to introduce to you Byron Calhoun. He's a distinguished graduate of the Air Force Academy. He has a residency in OBGYN and maternal fetal medicine, board certified in both of those. He's the professor and vice chair in the Department of OBGYN at West Virginia University in Charleston, and has done a lot of publishing, 60 peer-reviewed articles, presented over 100 scientific papers, 40 research projects, and has really contributed to the obstetrical literature in the area of perinatal hospice, really providing a cogent pro-life hospice alternative to partial birth abortion for fatal fetal anomalies. I think this is a topic you need to be aware of as you counsel your patients, whether you're in primary care, OBGYN, or in some other area. It's good to be knowledgeable of this area so you can recommend it to people that face this issue in their families. Byron, tell me about neonatal hospice. I mean, tell me some of this, maybe to start with a story of what the situation really involves.
I'm going to add it's actually perinatal hospice, which is a little bit different than neonatal, but it's very similar. It's tied together. And basically, the genesis of this was in 1996 when a lot of the partial birth abortion controversy the first time was going around. And we really didn't have a good way to handle patients who are given a diagnosis of a lethal anomaly for their babies. I mean, we had a lot of people talk about a lot of things, but there really wasn't a very organized or cogent plan for that. So what we did is we put together, when I was actually in Tacoma, Washington, a sort of a structured way to deal with these pregnancies. And that's really where it started. And over the last 13 years, it's kind of grown in this huge sort of grassroots movement. There's like over 70 of them now in the country and 7 international. It just keeps growing every day. I get contacts several times a month on people wanting to do it or interest in it.
What are some of the situations that you're dealing with?
Well, if you look at the literature out there, basically it says that about 0.2-0.3% of newborn or neonatal deaths are a result of lethal anomalies. What we're looking at usually are babies who have a lethal trisomy, say a trisomy 13 or a trisomy 18. It may be somebody has a baby has a very bad hypoplastic left heart. That could be in a baby with anencephaly. It could be children who have multiple anomalies in the place of significant genetic abnormalities that are not necessarily trisomies that just don't have the ability to survive either in utero or after delivery very long, most of the minutes, maybe hours, a few days.
How do you counsel when that diagnosis is made? How do you deal with patients? And I know you've done this many times, but it might be helpful for members as they run into some of these issues of how to counsel and advise patients as they get this type of diagnosis.
Sure. And I think the real issue is to have really good maternal fetal medicine or really good people doing your ultrasounds and your diagnosis. And I think that's really key. And most of the time, if they're in my lab, I mean, I see them and I do it. But if it's if somebody from someplace else, if you think there's something going on, you know, you really need to have a good, and I prefer, like I said, a Christian pro-life MFM, and there are a few of those around, actually, and talk to the patients. And I think the only way to do it is to just tell your patients in a very compassionate but very direct way and say, look, I think there's this anomaly or this particular problem with the baby. I'm not sure yet necessarily, and I may need more information, but I'm very concerned, and I think we need to talk about further evaluation, even second opinions if they want them. But if I'm convinced that I have a child who has, say, anencephaly, usually, which is pretty straightforward, or renal agenesis, no kidneys, I'm very, very direct with them, and I explain it in layman's terms. The baby doesn't have kidneys, won't make fluid, can't breathe, and will die after delivery. That baby does not have a brain, it's anencephaly, this child will not survive long after delivery.
How do you explain perinatal hospice to them?
Well, I think the easiest way to describe it is, Amy Kubelbeck is actually a dear friend of mine, she actually says, and I like her way she puts it, she says, really what you're allowing patients to do is to be parents. Mm-hmm. And everybody wants to be a parent. And what I tell them is, look, you can terminate your pregnancy, that's legal. We're not going to talk about that because you already know about that. What I want to explain to you is why don't we find a way to just to go along with your baby let's spend time with your baby, let's let you be a parent, and let's just move this along, whatever happens will happen, and we will allow you time to spend with your child. And most patients, in fact, the literature we've published, between 75 and 85% of patients, if presented an alternative structured option of taking care of them with myself and the neonatologist and my nurses and social services and all the things that people are allowed to have as resources for other things, just like regular pregnancies, actually choose hospice because they understand they'd want to spend time. They want to be a parent. They want to spend time with their baby. That's what they want.
How does the process undertaken? I mean, okay, the baby's born. What is involved in perinatal hospice?
I think the biggest thing is that they're allowed to have anticipatory grief. They're allowed to have time to spend with their baby while it's alive. They're allowed to develop a birth plan, just like they would if they had a baby who was going to survive, except the bittersweet part of this is they're not going to be able to probably go home with a living baby.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the part of this that's very difficult. And I think that from that perspective, they're allowed to develop, would they like to have oxygen on the baby? Do they want to have, you know, monitoring the baby? Do they want to have a cesarean section, which I've done for patients so they can have a live baby and they can baptize it or spend time with it? If that's very important to them, then that's certainly an option as well. Do they want comfort measures for the baby? Most of them do. Do they want to bathe their baby? There's all these things they can do for their baby, and we involve a neonatologist to have them there to make sure the diagnosis is correct, and we're very rarely wrong in this, but occasionally you'll have somebody who has something that you just weren't anticipating. But that's pretty unusual. But their patients are very well held close, and the nurses take time with them, and they're allowed to spend as much time with their baby as they want, have a big room for them, have family members in. We usually have photography done. The Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep organization is fabulous. They donate their time, professional photographers taking beautiful pictures of these babies and their families to give them the keepsakes because they won't have a lot of time other than this with their baby. So it's really important to spend that time with them. So it's a really big group effort.
How do you involve spiritual ministry into this? Do you get the chaplain, pastors, others involved?
I really strongly urge. We have a really good chaplain here. I've had fabulous luck with my chaplains. I mean, really good people, and they are usually right on board. And we try to involve their faith if they happen to be perhaps Jewish. We try to get the rabbis involved. We've had some Muslim families and try to get their mullahs involved. Most of the time we have pastors, that people have pastors or our chaplains involved. Our priests are involved, parish priests. And people's different faiths and people who don't have a faith, we always offer them either social services or the chaplains just as part of the participatory grief. And we have a huge grief program for follow-on after delivery where we follow them up 72 hours, about a week out, and then every month for about a year. And we have a grief support as well for the families that they can go to. So there's a lot of holding these people close, a lot of high touch, not so much high tech once we get to the point of the hospice diagnosis.
Sure. What kind of feedback do you get from parents a year or so later after they've been through this process? I know you've published on this, but what is their response, in large part?
Well, what's very interesting is even through the process of the grief, it's overwhelmingly positive because what they're so grateful for is the time that they were able to spend with the baby, with their child, with their family. And the family members even have expressed this. Initially, there's a lot of resistance because people think they're going to harm their family member, or why are you making them, quote-unquote, making them carry their baby? It's going to be better if they're not carrying this. And actually, the data is exactly the opposite, that when you terminate pregnancies and you prematurely shorten the grief or you try to truncate it, it doesn't work. And they do worse, actually, and the literature says that. So they're overwhelmingly positive because they get to come back and say, you know, my baby's life mattered. I got to be a parent. I got to spend time with my baby. I did the things I could do for my baby at the time. It was active. It wasn't passive. And for every moment my child lived, my baby felt love. My baby felt the parents. Everybody was there. That child never knew a moment when it wasn't loved. It wasn't held. It wasn't held sacred as another human being. And that's a tremendous gift to give to the baby and the family.
Sure. If a doctor wants to access this, how would they find out where it's available, or how would they find out more information if they actually like to start it in their own facility?
Sure. We have a lot of information on the APLOG website, which is the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which is aaplog.org. Mm-hmm. And then there's a huge amount of information on Amy Kubelbeck, again, has put together a wonderful clearinghouse, and that's perinatal, PERINATAL, hospice.org. And there's a lot of different programs that can be done and work together. Or, I mean, they could even contact me. I have I can give them my work email if they don't mind doing that. Is that okay for you
sure.
to do that on your show?
Yeah.
It's Byron, B-Y-R-O-N dot Calhoun, C-A-L-H-O-U-N, at CAMC.org. That's Charlie Alpha Mike Charlie dot O-R-G. And I can get back with them and connect them with people in their area, perhaps, or give them some different things that we use or ideas, or even come speak if they want sometimes.
That's great. Byron, I want to thank you for your leadership in this. It's a wonderful alternative, and I think such a life-honoring one. And I want to thank you for what you've done and the difference you've made. I just pray that it'll continue to spread across the country as it honors life, and I think it's a godly approach to what we need to be doing with these situations.
I just credit God with giving us the insight and the ability to do it, and it's, you know, basically for His glory and for all the children out there who are made in His image, and all those families who have suffered this. Just allow them to give them hope, and like I said, a real active, wonderful thing they can do for their babies. They can love their baby, they can be a parent for their baby, and are allowed to do so instead of giving them an option that's really not what they want and is not good for them and their family.
Thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Our time's so limited with patients, it seems to get shorter and shorter. I think that's why it's so important to have some great resources at your fingertips that you can recommend to people when they're facing serious situations. One of the ones in this area I think can be very helpful is called Letters to My Unborn Children, Meditations on the Silent Grief of Miscarriage. And really that applies to losing a young child, perinatally for any reason. It's available here at CMDA, and we've screened it. It's an excellent resource to pass on to really have ministry into people's lives during one of the most difficult times that moms and dads face. For a good number of years, we've had a CMDA credit card affinity program, which actually generated some funds for our Medical Education International and our Women in Medicine and Dentistry programs. Unfortunately, we were notified August 1st that the Bank of America no longer was going to continue that program with us because they have increased the size of organizations that qualify for this type of program. Now, if you have one of these cards still good, feel free to charge on it. It just won't bring any money to CMDA's mission programs. If you would like to continue to support MEI or Women in Medicine and Dentistry, we encourage you to do that. You can do it online with a credit card or, of course, the old-fashioned way with mail. But just to let you know that there's no longer a CMDA credit card affinity program. Another thing I want to mention on the financial end, if you are a contributor to CMDA above and beyond your dues, and I trust every one of you are, because dues only pays a small portion of our overall cost for this ministry each year. But I want to encourage you to become a regular contributor. And there's a way you can go online and just give us your credit card, automatically have your dues paid for every year, automatically have a deduction on a monthly, quarterly, semi-annual, or annual basis to support this ministry. I know I do this with our bills at home. It's just so easy. I don't have to worry about it. I know it's going to happen. If you'd like to do that, that is available, and it'll save us a lot of cost. Also want to encourage you to tell a friend about CMDA, a colleague, and let them know that they should join. People are much more likely to become a member, not because they got a mailing for us, not because they saw us in the news, not because of some program they attend, but because a friend says to them, "This has touched my life, and it can touch yours as well." And so I encourage you to do that. Work that into your conversations. We can grow the influence of this organization in the lives of many through your efforts. One of the other things we're trying to do is be better stewards of the finances God has given us. And one way, this experiment I must admit, is to start sending out some of our Christian Doctor's Digest as MP3s only, which decreases mailing cost and reproduction cost over time as people move away from CDs. I think at some point we may be doing this for all of our Christian Doctor's Digest outreach. But let us know how this works for you. Give us some feedback. Drop us a note. Send us an email. And if you like to get it that way now, say, "Hey, listen, Dave, just let me know the new issue is out and I can download it with a click." You can sign up for that online or just give us a buzz or drop us a note here at CMDA and you will get these as MP3s. So keep us informed. Let us know. We want your feedback because we work for you. I'd like to introduce our next guest, Rob Mole, who's an editor-at-large for Christianity Today magazine, has written on healthcare, business, books, ideas. He's written in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Books and Culture, Leadership Journal, many other publications. He's published a number of books, and one of those really caught my eye. It's called The Art of Dying, Living Fully into the Life to Come, a really whole new perspective that I think would be particularly helpful to us as healthcare professionals. I had the opportunity not long ago to sit down with Rob. Let's hear what he has to say. Rob picked up a copy of The Art of Dying and thought it was different than anything else I had read out there on the dying issue. What kind of caused you to decide to tackle this issue?
Well, thank you, first of all, Dave. I did want it to be something that was different. That was precisely because when I kind of looked through the bookshelves, I wasn't seeing what I wanted there on this topic. So I can give you a little bit of a background. You know, at the time that I started working on the book, I was an editor on staff at Christianity Today, and the Terri Schiavo debate was swirling. And I remember I was actually in the hospital when my daughter was born and watching that debate on television. And I just felt frustrated as we Christians were talking about it, how to deal with these end-of-life issues. And my frustration was that we quickly jump into politics, into bioethics. And I felt like that isn't necessarily the arena in which families are dealing with these issues and making these kinds of choices. And so I wanted to write a book that brought in what Christians have said over the centuries about death and about dying well and apply them into our very different situation today and hopefully provide a resource for, you know, professionals dealing with these issues as well as for families. And provide them a way to look at the end of life through a Christian lens and help guide choices that people have to make, and guide them in a way that would be honoring to God and also helpful and even a blessing to families as they face a really difficult period of life.
You know, a couple of themes in the book that I thought were quite unique. One was talking about the history of how the church has dealt with dying in the past compared to how we do now. What did you see in that research? I mean, the bottom line is you say, we just don't know how to die anymore. I mean, we do it, but we don't know how to do it.
That's true. And what was interesting is that we used to know. There was practices, there was a sort of base of knowledge that we as Christians had that we have essentially forgotten, and that's a complicated tale during the 19th century as lots in medicine changed and society changed. It was powerful for me to be reintroduced to this very robust tradition of dying that Christians practice, and they had names for it. In America in the 19th century, they called it the beautiful death or the happy death. And people, you know, in obituaries, we think of obituaries today as being short biographies of somebody's life. They used to tell stories in the newspaper of someone's final days or final moments. And this was part of the beautiful death tradition. And what the way it worked in the U.S. in the 19th century was just an extension of what Christians had been practicing for centuries, beginning with Jesus' own death. And I guess the key there is that as Christians saw that Jesus died and rose, Christians saw that that changed how we ought to approach death. That if we believe in a Savior who came to earth as a human being, died, and then defeated death on the cross, that should change how we approach our own death.
And what a great opportunity for a testimony through the dying process, which I think we've often lost. I know just at church Sunday, one of people in the church's grandfather had died, a young couple, And, you know, he'd gotten up, got dressed for go to church and just died. They found him in his bedroom. And everybody was saying, wow, that was great. Wasn't it just bang and he was in heaven? And yet you talk in the book about hoping for a gradual dying. Explain that.
One of the doctors I talked to has a practice not far from where I live. He says, you know, a lot of his patients would prefer to just kind of be hit by a truck and have it all end suddenly. And, you know, in that way, it may save people from a lot of pain. On the other hand, it can leave a lot unresolved, and it can be a lot more challenging for family members and for loved ones. And most importantly for the individual, part of this tradition of dying well that Christians practice was preparation. It involved spiritual preparation as well as, you know, instruction for other people. So the sort of classic deathbed scene that we think of someone's last words and final wishes and things like that, this is a living tradition. People actually did these things. And they have, you know, letters in the Civil War where people, because they couldn't be at home with their family members, they wrote out their last wishes and their and these things. We often think that we would be spared a lot if our dying was quick. But not only is that not true, but chances are dying is going to be a gradual process for most of the people that we take care of, the people that are in our families, and for ourselves as well. Just because of advances in medical technology, we're better able to treat things, and so people live longer, and their dying is often more extended. But I think that's an opportunity for us as Christians, for families, to really relearn these Christian practices of dying well, dying faithfully.
You talk about the themes of dying well, and you mentioned one, death requires preparation. And, you know, when we think of that, immediately what jumps to our mind is, you know, I need to have a will, I need to have a letter to my wife, you know, and everything in order, but often miss the things that have as much or more impact. Why don't you talk about some of those themes of preparation, spiritual event, how to actively prepare for death? Because I think they're not only things that we need to understand as healthcare professionals, but also things we can assist our patients that are going through the dying process, because we have a wonderful opportunity for ministry. Death is not when we turn away. Death is when we draw closer to those that are going through it.
Yeah. I just have a number of, you know, different thoughts. But first off, you know, Martin Luther wrote a letter to a friend, and it's published as A Sermon on Preparing to Die. And the first piece of advice that he gives is, get your earthly affairs in order. So definitely, you know, make a will and decide who will have your, you know, the powers of attorney and all of those legal issues that need to be taken care of. That was Martin Luther's first piece of advice. But then, having done that, allows us to then turn our attention heavenward. And this, you know, has a direct relation to the kind of healthcare choices that people make.
Mm-hmm.
Just yesterday in church, a woman was telling me about her mother, who is just having a hard, she's actually in hospice, but is having a hard time making decisions and realizing, you know, what is coming next. She just feels like, you know, she's got an illness that she's going to quickly get past, and then all will be well again. And her daughter realizes that this is not going to get better, and that's why she's in hospice. So, you know, the preparing ourselves personally, saying goodbye to our loved ones, whether that means actually saying goodbye or just saying whatever needs to be said, not leaving things unsaid, in a sense, completing our relationships with our loved ones. You know, last words are important, providing instruction if that's what needs to be done. Saying, I love you and I forgive you and I'm sorry. These things are all important aspects of preparing ourselves with our family members and in our relationships. And then turning our attention toward the life to come. You know, I firmly believe that as Christians, we do not die. We continue to live, and we live a more glorious life with God. But that is easier said than practiced, I think. And so, you know, as we take care of people, as we you know, grow older ourselves and see our bodies age. These are opportunities, I think, to turn our thoughts, turn our attention toward God and toward our eternal lives with Him.
Talk a little bit about caring for the dying. You know, that's something those of us in healthcare do all the time, and all of us will do with our family members, parents, other loved ones. What advice do you have?
You know, every situation is different, and often the advice that I give to people is I try to keep it simple, and that is just, you know, simply to be present. I was recently, and I cannot remember where, but I was recently reading some research that said that patients rate their doctors more highly just simply if they listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
They feel like that they've had better care if they have a doctor who will just sit and listen to their patients. And I think, you know, whether that's the doctor-patient relationship or our own relationship with family members who we're caring for, being present is just so, so important. We're going to find, and I know, you know, I volunteer with hospice, and people say, you know, oh, you have a special gift to be able to do that. And a lot of times I want to say, no, I just make the choice that I'm going to go be with this person and I'm going to be present with them. And I think that the most important thing that we can do is to just spend time with people. The same doctor that I mentioned earlier, I went on a round with him, with his patients at a nursing home. And, you know, I don't think that he dispensed much medical advice in, say, the 2 or 3 hours that I was with him. There was one patient there who had been there for quite some time, and she was almost mentally gone. You know, they were just taking care of her, and she mostly just laid on her bed. And he spent some time just holding her hand, talking with her. I should say talking to her because she wasn't able to respond. And just his manner, spending time with these patients, talking with them, in some way touching all of them, holding their hands, putting an arm around them, it just signaled to them that he valued them. He saw them as you know, sacred human beings created in the image of God. And, you know, there are all kinds of responsibilities in caregiving and difficulties, whether you're taking care of someone with dementia or taking care of someone with cancer or whatever it is. But the most important thing is just to be present. So I kind of rambled there, but being present is just so, so important, and it's the easiest thing. It's the first thing we think, you know, we can't do. We're too busy, or we are quick to make excuses for ourselves. But being present is just essential.
Yeah, and not ignoring what's happening. I mean, it's so easy for us as healthcare professionals to, you know, one more thing we can do and just kind of ignore what's really going on. This person is dying.
Yeah.
And not address the main issue, which is in their mind, the family's mind, and all the rest of it. And part of that being present is not to hide behind our professionalism and ignore the elephant in the room, that people realize it is there.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw that piece in the New Yorker by their doctor who writes for them. He had a piece on hospice in the New Yorker magazine. He basically wrote that it's just easier for him as a doctor to, you know, prescribe another treatment, to take another, you know, sort of medical course of action. He finds that it just easier to do. At least he can do something. And that's easier than sitting and listening and talking to patients and helping them through these issues and helping them to make wise choices at life's end. Sometimes it's just easier to do something, and we all feel that, whether we're, you know, in healthcare or whatever else, we feel the need to do something, when often we just need to be there.
Right. You talk, you have a chapter on the Christian funeral, which I don't think I've ever read a chapter on the Christian funeral. Talk about that a little bit. Before this time, I think it's a topic that's not really addressed. And Christian funerals, many of them are not what they used to be.
Yeah, the funeral has just changed significantly. And it's funny, we see evidences of how things used to be when we have a graveside service or something, but we don't see it anymore as a journey with someone to the resting place where their bodies will await the resurrection. My wife is from the East Coast, and I love to see the gravestones at the cemeteries nearby. While I was researching the book, I always took an opportunity to walk through an old cemetery And I just love the testimonies that these people have on their stones. Here I lie awaiting the resurrection. And I just thought, you know, that's just a wonderful testimony. And that's a large part of what the funeral is churches sort of restating what it believes in terms of the gospel, the faith that despite this death that we're mourning, that we do believe that the grave has no victory. And then the other thing here is that we often see funerals as, we don't want to call them funerals anymore. We want to call them celebrations of life or memorials. But this is really a time, and it's just so important to take the time to reaffirm our faith, to knit the community back together that has suffered a loss, and to restate our fundamental beliefs that we believe in a Lord who has defeated death. And the funerals that are just sort of biographies, funerals that are meant to simply soothe emotions, although funerals ought to do that, I don't think that they meet the full range of who we are as humans created in God's image.
And those customs, you know, of sharing the gospel at the funeral to those people that come that may not know him, and let that testimony of that person's life speak so loud at that moment that God can use it to touch their lives. I remember one of the things, you know, when I think about death and dying, I did my residency in the Southeast, down the Deep South, and I remember the first time I saw a funeral cortege go by, you know, and that's not unusual, you know, they've police cars stopping traffic and they're taking the casket.
Right.
And then down south, everybody pulls over to the side of the road, gets out and stands in respect.
Oh, wow, man.
You know, you're just kind of going, wow, you know, because it typical is, well, I've got to go to that funeral. I knew the family or something. This was a whole different sense of this is a respect for the individual, a celebration of what God has done in their lives. You know, we need to make Christian funerals more like that. Well, Rob, you've done such a wonderful job with the book, and it's so practical. It's full of stories from your hospice experience. I could just see a patient that I've dealt with, many of them that are dealing with death and dying, and what a wonderful resource this would be to put in their hands to help them understand that, their families to deal with it. It's well worth a read by every Christian healthcare professional. I just want to thank you for not only your dedication in taking care of the dying through hospice, but sharing your experience and doing all this research, which is going to help each one of us to do what we do all the time better than we've ever done it before. So thank you for taking some time to be with us.
Well, thank you, David.
I do encourage you to get a copy of The Art of Dying. It's just a great resource for patients and something you should read. Now, I'm like you. I fight to find time to read, you know, take a book on a plane, do whatever I can. But I think discipline and regularity really makes a difference. Taking 10 or 15 minutes as you're going to bed at night just to have a book at your bedside and read a chapter. And if you do that regularly, you're going to get through a dozen, two dozen books a year. And we want to help you to know which ones out there we think will be most helpful. If you like a copy of The Art of Dying, it is available here at CMDA online or at our toll-free number, 888-230-2637. But this should be a book that you're dispensing, you're prescribing, and a book you should read yourself. As we close this issue of Christian Doctor's Digest, I thought I'd just bring you up to date on some family news. Not my personal family, but CMDA family. God is doing so many good things. This past summer, we had new medical missionary orientation, something that our Center for Medical Missions has done for a number of years. You'd be thrilled to know that 55 new medical missionaries attended this conference. In fact, we had to split it into two conferences back to back, helping them to really understand how to do medicine, how to keep balance on the mission field, how to deal with the ethical issues they're going to face with unlimited need and limited resources. It was just a wonderful time. In September, we had a great meeting with record attendance with mission executives and organizations that are involved in medical missions. And over 35 were in attendance, almost double than what we normally have coming together. God is just stirring thing up in medical missions, and I can't help but think it's to really complete the Great Commission. Many of these people are going to unreached people groups and to difficult-to-access countries. And so let's remember them in prayers. And CMDA is just stirring things up on our campuses through the Global Missions Health Conference, which just will be in a few weeks. God is stirring in people's hearts, and I think the key for carrying the gospel into these hard-to-reach areas is medical and dental outreach. So be in prayer for this. We're continuing to have great effect in Washington, and I hope you're taking a few moments to read The Point and keep up to date on some of the key issues that are going on. But our influence just continues to grow, a lot of it behind the scenes, meeting with ambassadors, meeting with staff of representatives and senators, and meeting with those people, and USAID, and God is just giving us much more influence than I thought we would ever have on the important issues where we provide expert information, expert testimony, and make a tremendous difference. And probably the thing I'm most excited about is what God is doing on campuses. Did you know that CMDA is now on 249 medical and dental school campuses across the country? We've had 7 more added just this past year as more schools are coming online. The number of part-time and full-time staff is increasing as local doctors come together and get a burden for ministry into the academic institutions close by and form a local council. And we come alongside with training and then help them find a staff member if they need one that can work with those students. It's just phenomenal what God is doing. I was down in Texas not long ago and at San Antonio, the first place we ever had a local council, and now there's 2 full-time staff members, and 85% of the incoming dental class there at the dental school signed up to be kept informed about what's happening with CMDA. Over 100 students and graduate docs are going every month down to the border on mission trips. It's just exciting to see God working in people's lives, and I get these testimonials every month that just stir my heart as students talk about how CMDA is their anchor line. It's their island during those difficult days of training, and how God's teaching them, preparing them, and how excited they are to go out in ministry. And I'm encouraged. Everybody's kind of like, well, things are getting worse and worse in our culture, but God is moving in Christian healthcare in ways we've never seen before, ways I could not even imagine 19 years ago when I came on at CMDA. Together, we are doing a lot in over 45 different ministries that the CMDA has. Our latest Women in Medicine and Dentistry Conference and how that touched so many, many lives. How well our board is working together, working on another 5-year strategic plan and looking forward with anticipation of moving even into new areas. What PACS is doing in Africa, training Christian national surgeons to reach out as missionaries to their own people. Work that's going on now in family practice and dentistry in these same areas of trying to train nationals to be missionaries to their own people and becoming enablers, not just doers, in medical missions. God's doing fantastic things, and it's due to you. It's due to your prayers. It's due to your involvement. It's due to your financial support. I just want you to know that you are changing the face of healthcare. You're changing the heart of healthcare. And people are coming to Christ. People are being strengthened in their faith. And the gospel is going out in this country and literally around the world. God has blessed us above and beyond what we could ever have imagined. So thank you for your faithfulness. Thank you for what you're doing. And until we get a chance to get together again, I just pray that God will bless you, use you, teach you, and make you effective in His vineyard. God bless.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations.